listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Wiggert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from a Wisconsin candidate for a Democratic National Committee leadership position about his plans and hopes for the party.
First, from an unpredictable and sometimes chaotic presidential election to our own state's recount effort, politics dominated the headlines in Wisconsin in 2016.
Now, with 2017 just underway, what will the new year bring for politics in the state? Stephen Walters joins us now with his predictions for the new year. He's senior producer for Wisconsin Eye and former Capitol Bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks very much for asking me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you'd written a piece listing your 2017 predictions with a pundit caveat. They may not all come true.
It's dangerous to be a pundit.
But let's start with the governor's race. And I think you feel pretty solid on this one. You're thinking Governor Walker will try to continue to be Governor Walker.
Really, there's no doubt in my mind that the governor will seek a third term. He has said he'll announce that after he signs the budget. I think you'll see signs tomorrow in his State of the State. I think it'll have three themes. I think it'll talk about the economic progress, and I think he'll talk about the special session for the heroin epidemic that he just called last week. And finally, he'll talk about realigning the workforce. He'll strike an upbeat note, and this is a State of the State that will be given by a governor who wants a third term.
And that may have been sealed when the Republican candidate, who is not Scott Walker, won the election. If things had come out differently, maybe not such a sure thing.
I still think the governor enjoys the platform being governor. It gives him a national visibility. He now has a Rolodex, if you will. Remember the old term Rolodex of large campaign contributors?
Yeah.
We can still say that. So, yeah, there's no doubt. I think the governor is going to seek a third term.
And you don't have a super solid prediction on who might run against him. The Democrats will be trying to find a candidate.
Well, I think potentially five. Senator Tim Cullen, former Senator Tim Cullen of Janesville, I think.
And
will
he's
announce.
Saying he's gonna,
yeah.
Pretty much.
Yes, he is. He's telling you the same thing he's telling me. Jefferson County District Attorney Susan Happ, if you go to her website, it's taking a statewide view. Eau Claire Representative Dana Walks. Senator Kathleen Vinehout ran for governor in the primary for the recall. She didn't fare very well. And locally, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi, I think, would love to run, but another Dane County Democrat. How did that fare in 2014?
Right, not slam dunks there. Are Democrats hoping for an outside candidate? Do you write about maybe hoping for another candidate from the business world? Though again, that didn't necessarily work out for them.
Well, I think many people wanted Catherine Gale to take it seriously, the former CEO of Gale Foods. And she has indicated no, and I think unpredictable is Madison businessman Kevin Conroy.
Do you see Democrats trying to pick someone, anoint them, and let them go through, or let a messy primary go ahead and see who comes out on top?
I really think there'll be a messy primary with up to five candidates.
And do you think that that's better for a party to let that primary? I mean, look what happened in the presidential election. Democrats tried to ride through with their chosen candidate. It's a messy thing for the Republicans. Which side won?
The political scientists, I think, who say that primaries are good for candidates. It allows them to test themes. It allows them to test their staffers. Yes, it costs them money, but it's a real exercise in how good a candidate you're going to be in a primary.
We'll get back to some other elections in a bit. But you went out on a limb here. State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, he's been in this job for a while. You see him hitting the road, maybe heading to Washington, D.C.
Well, I do. And last Tuesday, Mr. Fitzgerald met with the Capitol Press Corps and said, look, it's still out there. It's still on the table, to his credit. I commend him for saying that. He has been straight up. I have talked to the Trump administration. He wants a significant job. He joked to a Milwaukee talk show host, how about Ambassador to Ireland, ha-ha, which has to be taken seriously. But when you look at Senator Fitzgerald, he's a retired U.S. Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel. He's been in the Senate for 22 years. That's a bit of herding cats. There's no doubt in my mind he is open to a job in the Trump administration.
Talking to Steve Walter from Wisconsin Eye, he recently wrote a piece with his predictions for what's going to happen in Wisconsin politics in 2017, going through at least some of them today. Back to elections. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin up for re-election at the same time as the governor will be. Where do you see challenges coming from for Republicans?
Well, I think Senator Fitzgerald, if he doesn't go to Washington, may consider that. The assistant Senate Majority Leader, Leah Vukmir, is interested in that, as in Eric Hovde, Madison businessman. And let's see.
And he's run for office before.
He ran in 2012 and finished second to Tommy Thompson. And then Sean Duffy, Congressman Duffy, who raised his profile greatly with the presidential campaign. I think there's a reason he recently referred to the communist governments in Madison, kind of a laying down a marker. So I think there are three potential candidates against Senator Baldwin.
Now, we're making predictions here for 2017. These are elections in 2018. But given that our election cycles are approaching infinity at this point, whoever's running, we're going to know about it or get strong signals by the time this year's out.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. We're now into the era of full-time campaigning, full-time fundraising.
And any reason to believe that Senator Tammy Baldwin wouldn't run for re-election?
Absolutely not.
So
absolutely not.
Her against Republican TBD is the matchup we're looking to see.
Yeah, you saw a press release today on her introducing a bill trying to salvage the Affordable Care Act. So there's no doubt in my mind she's going to seek re-election.
Now, one prediction you didn't make in your piece, but you'll probably go with, and I would too, Wisconsin State Supreme Court Justice Annette Ziegler, probably going to win her election next year because there is nobody on the ballot against her.
She has no opposition. It's the first time a Supreme Court incumbent has been in a post since 2006. When you look at the last four elections for Supreme Court, conservative candidates and their third-party supporters won three out of four, and they spent a total of $8 million, according to the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. But more moderate candidates and their third-party groups supporting them spent only $5 million. So that's a big difference in low turnout spring elections. So you and I agree, Rob, Justice Ziegler will be reelected April 4.
Unless something really weird happens. Getting to some policy points here. The transportation budget sticking point, this is within the Republican Party. There have been issues. What do you see happening this time around with transportation?
Well, I think that eight-hour Assembly Transportation Committee hearing really helped Assembly Republicans make the case why there has to be some type of revenue uppers. Our 30.9-cent gas tax hasn't been increased since 2006. Our $75 annual vehicle registration fee hasn't been increased since 2008. And we have a $939 million shortfall if we wanted to continue building highways at the current rate over the next 2 years, the next two-year state budget.
Just hearing in the news today, a Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce survey on whether Wisconsinites want a gas tax, pretty evenly divided between yes, we do, and no, we don't. This is the sticking point, isn't it? There's a lot of ideas out there, and any particular idea more people seem to dislike than like, so nobody can settle on one solution.
And then, meanwhile, Governor Walker has said, look, the only way I would agree to that is, first of all, I'm not going to raise a gas tax, I'm not going to raise the vehicle registration fee, and then there's a however in there. If there are offsets and cuts in other state taxes, he might accept that.
Local governments really hoping for some
personal property tax.
Oh, okay.
$297 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you raised our gas tax 5 cents, and if you raised 5 cents a gallon, if you raised our $75 vehicle registration fee $10 over the course of the next biennium, you would raise, and I just checked these figures, $400 million. Then if you borrowed the $500 million that the Department of Transportation budget proposes, you're up to $900 million, almost that meeting that shortfall.
But that'd be a lot to offset.
That's a big offset needed.
Before we let you go, Wisconsin waiting on a U.S. Supreme Court hearing and decision on how we draw our voting lines here in the state. Democratic, in effect, challenge to the way Republicans drew the lines. What's your prediction from the U.S. Supreme Court?
This was the one prediction that I had the most uncertainty about. I just feel that the ninth Supreme Court justice is not going to be named in time to hear this. And I feel Justice Kennedy is going to say, okay, the remaps that the Republicans drew in 2011 were okay in terms of the numbers being equal, one person, one vote. I'm going to let stand the Court of Appeals ruling. But punditry is dangerous, and that's the one I perhaps have the least certainty about.
We'll flip a coin on that one. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for asking me. Thank you very much.
It's Stephen Walters, senior producer for Wisconsin Eye and former Capitol Bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've been talking about his predictions with varying degrees of certainty for what 2017 is going to bring for Wisconsin politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan are both in support of repealing the Affordable Care Act. We'll talk with a healthcare expert about how that could affect Wisconsinites.
By the way, next Tuesday at 3, Governor Walker delivers his State of the State address. We'll be airing that address live, as well as the Democratic response, and then Central Time gets back on the air with some reporting, coverage, and analysis, and, of course, your opinions on what Governor Walker had to say. That's coming up next Tuesday at 3 here on the Ideas Network.
And we were speaking with Don Gagne from NPR earlier, asking about what you want the next administration to know about your community, where you live, and you can still go online now, continue that conversation. Don Gagne, by the way, will be in Milwaukee on Wednesday. You can go there and leave your comments over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, the presidential race has wrapped up. In the aftermath, the Democratic National Committee is selecting new leadership. The people voting in this one will be largely state party officials. After suffering a major loss in the 2016 election, Democrats will be choosing leaders to determine the future direction of the party.
Jason Ray is a Democrat from Milwaukee and a member of the DNC, where he chairs the Youth Council. In 2004, he became the committee's youngest member at just 17 years old. Now he's running for secretary of the DNC, and he joins us to tell us more. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Having me.
Jason, why are you running for DNC secretary?
Well, I'm running for secretary. It's one of our 9 national officer positions that DNC members will elect in February at our winter meeting in Atlanta. And I think the secretary has probably one of the most important roles in our party. And I really am running because I want to do more to create greater transparency among the DNC and also work to engage members more outside of the roles of just planning our DNC meetings and keeping the roster.
And what experience would you say you're bringing to the job that makes you a good fit?
Well, I think first is my 12 years of experience as a member of the DNC. This is traditionally a role that works and engages with members, and having been a member of the National Committee for a few years now, almost a decade, it really enables me to understand kind of what members are looking for. But, you know, when I really think about it, it really is about how to increase transparency and really bring new people into the fold. And that's something that I've done in Wisconsin. During my 12 years as a DNC member, I have issued a report after each DNC meeting about what it is that we're discussing, what we're talking about, what we're voting on. And as secretary, I want to produce a report like that that we can share with members, that they can send to their networks across the country. I want to make sure that it's something that we're posting publicly. I think the more that we can do to remove this veil of secrecy that many people have about what we're doing, it'll go a long way in building trust and bringing new folks into the party.
Right. You've been talking a lot about, as you are now, transparency that suggests you think that that's been a sticking point, a problem for Democrats. Where do you think Democrats could do better when it comes to transparency?
I think the first and foremost is really just making sure that the rules of our party are transparent. I think that is something we saw during the primary process between Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders this year. And I think the secretary has a unique role in really helping to publicize, helping to talk about those rules, and really engaging with folks. One of the things that I want to do as secretary is really get away from D.C. And serve as a party surrogate. You know, here in Wisconsin alone, I've gone to more than 60 different county party and congressional district events over the last 2 years and talked about what the DNC is doing. I've given updates. I've explained the rules and the process of the party. And as secretary, I want to get away from D.C., and I want to make sure that we are traveling the country, engaging with members, specifically members in rural parts of the country, who may feel left behind and left out of the party, and really bringing more people in.
And I understand you have roots in rural Wisconsin yourself. You're in Milwaukee now, but is that something you see as a strength in your own background?
Absolutely. You know, I got my start in politics up in my hometown of Rice Lake, you know, a town of just about 8,000. And I started by riding my bike to county party meetings before I could even vote, and got involved in the county party, was elected the vice chair of the county party, and then really got my start in organizing in the rural parts of Wisconsin. And now living in Milwaukee and working here, I've seen both how things are done in rural communities and in urban communities. And I think that's a really unique skill set that not a lot of folks have, which I think really helps my candidacy.
Now, as secretary, you will be running against incumbent DNC secretary, former Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. Why would you say that you should get the job instead of someone with more political experience?
I think the role of secretary is one that's really about being an advocate for DNC members. And, you know, I think I really respect the mayor and the work that she's done, but I really want to bring a different perspective to the office of secretary. And I think I've got some fresh ideas that will really energize, that will engage more folks. As I've talked to members across the country, I've been making phone calls to fellow DNC members, talking about my candidacy and explaining my vision, hearing their feedback. And it's been a really positive response that I've heard from folks who are looking for a new direction, who are looking for someone who will engage them on a regular basis. You know, I want to build programs that will make DNC members feel included to make sure that their voice is heard on the national levels. And I think, in particular, having been a member for 12 years, I understand that unique member perspective and how best to serve members in the role of secretary.
We're talking with Jason Rainite right now. He's a Milwaukee Democrat who's with us to talk about his run for secretary of the Democratic National Committee. And Jason, 2016 was a tough year for Democrats from the executive office on down. Where do you think the Democratic Party stands today?
You know, 2016 was a really difficult year, and I think we as a party are going to have a lot of work to do going forward. And I think, you know, we're already starting to plan for, we've got some fall elections in 2017 out in Virginia, and we've got some other places. But I think what our focus is going to have to be is first as a party on bringing folks together and really uniting the party together. And I think then after that, it really is going to be about building our bench of candidates. I think we as a party have to do more to engage and get people elected at school board levels, at city council levels, county board. Those are going to be our future candidates for mayors, for state house, for governors, for U.S. Senate, U.S. House. And we really need to be investing right now in the future of our party and making sure that we're building that pipeline of leadership.
And there have been, in terms of healing, some stark divisions between supporters of Bernie Sanders and supporters of Hillary Clinton. They got along at the end of the race, but those divisions are lingering. Do you think that that is a rift that can be healed?
I absolutely do. You know, I've been making calls to Democrats all across this country, I've talked to people who supported Senator Sanders and those who supported Secretary Clinton in the primaries. And I think we are really committed as Democrats to coming together. And when I look at members of the DNC, I think there's a real willingness to know that we, you know, can't let Donald Trump get away with things. And we need to have a united front over the next 4 years. But we need to be building programs right now that will help us start securing early victories so that in 2020 we can retake the White House. But knowing that we have so much more to do even between now and then at the state level across this country.
The high-profile race for DNC chair is between Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison and U.S. Labor Secretary Tom Perez. Who do you think would be best for the party?
Well, you know, and I wouldn't say just between them. We've got three other candidates out there as well right now who are running. Starting this weekend, the DNC will hold regional forums. The first one's in Phoenix, and then we're on to Houston, Detroit, and Baltimore. I've had a chance to talk to all of the chair candidates, and I know many of them well, and I think each of them brings a unique ability, a unique skill set to the party, and I'm excited, hopefully as our next secretary, to work with any one of them to help get Democrats elected up and down the ticket, to really increase transparency in our party, and really help Democrats be successful once again.
And you've talked about what's needed is to heal the rifts that may remain from the election, to move on, to be united. But how do you do that in practical terms?
You know, I think it really is, you know, in my mind, and it's the reason I chose to run for secretary, I think it's really about the transparency. I think it's really about making sure that folks have an understanding of what's going on. The DNC has some important committees that are going to be meeting soon, including one, the Unity Change Commission. That was a product of the convention around the role of superdelegates and the role of caucuses in our party's process. And I think it's going to be very important that the Secretary really work to proactively communicate both when those meetings are, but how members of the public can weigh in, what decisions are being made at every level, to really make sure that we are opening up the process to more folks and that people don't think it's decisions made in a smoke-filled room somewhere, but that we're really talking about how people can have a voice in the party and what's being decided.
Looking at Wisconsin, Wisconsin has voted for a Republican in this election in the White House, as well as majority Republican state legislation right now, legislators. Why do you think Democrats have lost their footing in Wisconsin?
You know, I think 2016 obviously was a bad year in Wisconsin. It's one that I hope was an anomaly for us. And, you know, I think we will do better in 2018. But I think it's really going to be incumbent upon us to make sure that we're engaging folks in rural parts of the state going forward.
So you think it's an anomaly? You think it was a blip on the radar and Wisconsin will toggle back toward Democrats, at least for presidential elections?
I hope so. It's something that I'm going to be working every day to ensure happens. You know, I think it was a bit of a wave year we saw. But, you know, I'm optimistic that when we start now kind of building that we will be successful in the future. And I'm hoping as our next secretary of the DNC that I can help make sure that we're putting Wisconsin and the Midwest really at the forefront and really focusing our attention on this part of the country again.
And you said also you wanted to travel and hear from people, talk one-on-one, get a sense of what people are thinking and feeling, what their concerns are. Is it something you think that Democrats missed maybe in Wisconsin and beyond?
Absolutely. You know, I've always found it during my time as a DNC member that traveling and listening to folks and letting them be heard is key. And it's something that I want to do as our next secretary, is to make sure that folks know that they have somebody that will listen to them, will take their concerns to heart, and we'll really work to involve as many people in the process and build an inclusive Democratic Party.
Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jason Ray. He's a Milwaukee Democrat who joined us to talk about his run for Secretary of the Democratic National Committee.
Coming up, a healthcare expert joins us to talk about how a repeal of the Affordable Care Act could affect Wisconsinites and look at some of the options for replacing the bill after it is repealed, as is expected under the new Congress and president. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's this week's edition of Reveal. You got that new computer or phone you wanted for the holidays, but what happens to your old gadgets? They might not end up where you expect. Environmentalists follow the global trail of America's electronic cast-offs. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, repealing the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, has been on the Republican agenda since the law was put into place. Now that Republicans have control of the House, Senate, and executive branch, repeal of the health care law seems likely. Here's President-elect Donald Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan talking about their plans for the Affordable Care Act.
We are repealing and replacing Obamacare.
Obamacare is failing. It must be replaced. We're going to do that. We're excited about it. And the point I would put people's minds at ease is we can fix these problems. We can fix what was broken in healthcare without breaking what was working in healthcare. And that is exactly what we're proposing.
But a report from the nonpartisan Urban Institute late last year showed the number of uninsured Americans would go up by more than 100% if Congress repeals the Affordable Care Act without immediately replacing it. This report estimated the number of uninsured people in Wisconsin would more than double from about 300,000 now to more than 600,000 if the Affordable Care Act is repealed and not replaced.
Thomas Oliver joins us now to talk about the impact that repealing the health care law could have on Wisconsin. He's a professor of Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we start digging into details, can you lay out what you see as some of the big picture options for what might be coming this year on an Affordable Care Act repeal and possible replacement?
Well, I think there's no doubt that from a political perspective, the Republicans have to pass some legislation that is labeled as repealing the Affordable Care Act. What we actually are going to see is really a complete mystery at this point, though, because some of the law cannot actually be repealed without overcoming a filibuster in the United States Senate. So only things that affect directly the federal budget are allowed to be put through the budget process and pass with a simple majority in the U.S. Senate. So that stops a lot of things from going through right away, anyway, unless Democrats join with Republicans in supporting a repeal. The other thing is there is no replacement. There's been a lot of discussion about that now for 6 years, but there's nothing in the books that suggests what might replace the Affordable Care Act. And finally, from a bigger picture standpoint, the Affordable Care Act is a really huge fix to a lot of problems in the United States healthcare system, and we've seen pretty drastic improvements over the last few years. We have historically low numbers, proportion of the United States population that is uninsured, about 8.9% earlier this year. We haven't seen under 30 million Americans uninsured since the first Bush administration in the 1980s. We also have seen record slowdowns in spending to the point where people are saving. Every American is now, over these 5 years, estimated to save $8,000 each. That's over $1,600 per year from a slowdown in spending. So those are not visible things that we notice, but the rhetoric that both the healthcare system itself and the Affordable Care Act are broken are really overheated, I think, and it's actually the opposite. There's been a lot of healing compared to where we were in 2007, 2008, 2009. And so, you know, what Republicans who do have control of all three branches of government, what they want to do now is really gets down to more practical issues of what is there to do and how is it going to affect typically millions of people.
One of the big things about the Affordable Care Act was that it was a big thing. There were, as you mentioned, a lot of different pieces and parts to it. We've heard from Donald Trump and some others the idea that, hey, we can maybe keep some of these things people like, keeping kids on their parents' insurance or children on their parents' insurance up to age 26, not allowing people to be excluded because of existing conditions. But can we have that kind of a la carte approach to changing the Affordable Care Act, taking away most of it, leaving in bits and pieces?
You certainly can in the short term. That would be a very popular thing to do. The problem is you're then inviting the younger, healthier people to stay out of the system entirely, and their funds and their low risk means that everybody who does stay insured is going to face much, much higher costs on average. And so you would see an explosion of insurance premiums for older, middle-aged people. And you'll also see increase in what the costs of Medicare are going to be. And with the Affordable Care Act helped fill in hundreds to thousands of dollars per Medicare beneficiary for people who use a lot of prescription drugs each year. And if you just repealed it, there goes those subsidies as well as the subsidies for the underage 65 population to get access to affordable health care.
Talking to Tom Oliver from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at options of repealing and replacing all or part of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have had pieces of plans out there that we've heard talked about, at least allowing more competition across state lines is one of them. The idea that this is a better solution by allowing more companies to be in the game in a state like Wisconsin or any other state, that will lead to competition, help drive down the costs of insurance. Do you think that that could help ameliorate, limit some of the losses to insurance coverage if the act is repealed?
Well, what that does is allow really cheap insurance plans that don't actually amount to what most of us think of as real insurance. You would have all the companies based in the state that has the least requirements for coverage and quality, and then they'd be able to sell those really cheap policies across state lines. So we'd be getting Delaware or South Dakota or Montana kinds of plans that wouldn't actually be there for the amount of coverage that we need for expensive days in the hospital, for quality surgeries, for coverage of prescription drugs, and so forth. So the idea that competition produces lower costs in the healthcare system is actually completely at odds with international information and data experience in Europe, in Japan, Taiwan, lots of other places.
Let's dig into the impact of the Affordable Care Act here in Wisconsin in particular. When we look at the marketplace and the other features of the act, how big a deal has this been in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, that's the, again, I alluded to that earlier and then didn't follow through, so I apologize. But basically, only 4% of all Wisconsin residents are getting their insurance coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. Remember, the state chose not to set up its own marketplace, so the federal government is operating it for Wisconsin, along with a number of other states. But only 220,000 or so Wisconsin residents get their health insurance through that marketplace. So if you just wiped that away, some of them might be able to go and get coverage elsewhere, but it would likely be more affordable. There's probably a reason that they came to that marketplace. They either didn't have access to any kind of employer-sponsored coverage, or they had access to very bad coverage or poor plans or very high prices in the individual insurance market. So building larger pools of insurance is the way to lower costs for virtually everybody across the board, unless you simply don't have much coverage and you don't need it. But that's taking a big chance, obviously.
So that's 200-some thousand on the marketplace. We mentioned that study from the Urban Institute saying that the number of uninsured people in Wisconsin would more than double from 300,000 to more than 600,000. Where would some of those other people come from if that study is accurate?
Well, there were tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who were required to be added to the Medicaid program and get coverage there. Because formerly, anyone who did not have dependent children in the home was not eligible for Medicaid, even if you had, even if you were unemployed or had very, very low income or were in between jobs or things like that. So there's tens of thousands of folks who were added to Medicaid, and those people would be presumably immediately dropped if we went right back to where we were without a requirement to cover people up to the federal poverty level. There would be other people who are just going to drop out because subsidies, which are pretty generous for people making even $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year in their household, those will disappear if you repeal the Affordable Care Act. And without that, people can't afford $15,000 a year family coverage, which is, you know, the average for a family of four or five people these days. So it's people will not choose to be uninsured, but they will simply not be able to pay those bills along with, their homes and they're putting food on the table and other things. So that's probably where the Urban Institute information comes from, but they're a pretty reliable, pretty nonpartisan source of information.
Talking to Tom Oliver now from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about how the repeal of the Affordable Care Act could affect Wisconsinites.
And we're taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. How has the Affordable Care Act affected your life? What would your life be like without that health care law? And what would you like to see in a replacement law? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now about how the repeal of the Affordable Care Act could affect Wisconsinites. Tom Oliver is with us from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How would a repeal of the Affordable Care Act affect you? What would you like to see replace it? Or do you think the law should stay? Has it changed your health coverage for better or for worse over the last few years? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Scott is with us in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi, yes. I'd like to make a comment about the negative of the Affordable Care Act. I guess I'm a healthy male, and my insurance from the last 8 years ago till now has doubled in premium. My deductible went from $1,000 to $5,000 deductible for the same exact insurance. And I was wondering how this is supposed to help me in the first place.
And Scott, can I ask, are you insuring yourself? Are you insured through an employer?
I'm insured through an employer through United Health.
Got it. Thanks a lot, Scott. So, Tom, people out there not directly affected by the Affordable Care Act, not using it, but seeing their premiums go up on private insurance and their deductibles go up as well.
Yeah, well, that's a trend that has been going on probably for 15, 20 years, where employers maintain coverage, but they shift the burden of cost, especially through very large deductibles, onto their workers. And that is, I think, a very unfortunate development, because then it makes it very difficult for people to actually use their coverage unless they have something very, very bad go wrong with them. You can say that gives incentive to not use unnecessary health care, but I think my perspective is that should be something that physicians and employers and insurance companies should negotiate and have good guidelines on, rather than simply dumping it and saying, do some good shopping, especially when you get sick. So Scott is suffering, I think, something that we've seen for a long time for virtually all Americans with employer-sponsored coverage, as that has slipped in terms of the quality of that coverage and the guarantee that it really provides for people without forcing them to spend quite a bit of money out of their own pocket year after year after year. Americans spend huge amounts of money out of pocket for health care even when they have health insurance, and that goes for Medicare beneficiaries as well, by the way.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call, and good luck to you. Is there a fundamental problem that healthcare costs are going up regardless of who pays for them? The actual cost of providing medical coverage has been going up, and if so, are we doing things to try to contain that?
Well, yes and no. The cost of care will inevitably go up in an industry like healthcare that is both heavily labor-based and heavily technology-based. As new technology comes along in healthcare, it tends to be more expensive than what it's replacing, in part because there's patents and there are pricing opportunities available, as we've heard about with a lot of drugs in the last couple of years, where there were very large price increases. But here's where the solution is to get bigger, not smaller. No, don't have more competition with smaller groups of people all trying to get their best deal, but rather put everybody or as many people as possible into a single pool of insurance so you smooth the risk, and that lowers what people need to pay as a baseline and should allow people to slow out of pocket costs. But back to your core question, no, we've seen a very dramatic slowdown, historically low growth in healthcare spending as a country in the last few years. And that is almost certainly attributable to the efforts of the Affordable Care Act to bring much more quality control and some kind of oversight of price increases in most areas. And so while some individuals, especially those who are part of very small groups getting insurance, small employers, or getting it on their own, could have seen very, very high price increases, By and large, the average increase has gone very, very slowly, and that's what I was saying at the top of the show. We've actually been saving thousands of dollars per person in this country compared to where we would have been without the Affordable Care Act, as estimated by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which serves both Republicans and Democrats.
Talking to Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about the Affordable Care Act, likely to be a target of repeal, likely very soon, and what kind of replacements might be in the works for it, the impact that might have, especially here in Wisconsin. We'll go next to Byron with us in Wausau. Byron, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Byron?
I'm concerned that the restriction on the amount of administrative costs that insurance companies can charge is going to get lost. A number of years ago, I heard a talk from Surgeon General Koop, and he was talking about the fact that insurance companies were spending as much as 35% of everything they took in on premiums for administration. Now, it's down now limited by the Affordable Care Act to 20%. Even though, interestingly, that's more than any other country in the world spends on administration. And I'm afraid that it'll just turn insurance companies free to give executives very high salaries.
Byron, thanks for the call. Tom, the Affordable Care Act limiting administrative costs that companies can charge, he says.
Yeah, it was. There have been, again, with smaller insurance companies who are operating more in certain markets than others, they do spend a lot on overhead, which is administration. There's a lot of rationing by reviewing whether you need a second opinion or whether you have prior approval, or disapproving payments for certain kinds of care that people got. There are executive salaries, of course, are part of the picture, but they're not a very large part. But the issue is, do we really need a country that relies on for-profit health insurance? Most of our European countries and Japan have dozens of health insurance companies, but they're all nonprofit. They are forced and required to take anyone who wants to buy the coverage, and they negotiate payments across the board, and they have much, much lower overhead, as Byron points out. We're operating about 10-11% overhead as a country. Other countries are at 4-5%. Our Medicare program operates at about 2% overhead. And so, again, privatization per se is not really, a solution to if you want lower costs for most of us over the long run.
As we start to wrap up, Tom, how do you see the current uncertainty over what's going to happen, how the act would be repealed, what might replace it, affecting healthcare coverage now while we're waiting?
Well, I think it's going to be the question of, are there messages coming from the right people? And that means voters who voted for people who are in power right now. If the voters from rural communities realize that money for community health centers, money for the National Health Service Corps that brings doctors, young doctors, to rural communities who would not otherwise be there and would not set up practice in those communities, if they realize that preventive services, which are covered at no out-of-pocket cost on Medicare and in private health insurance plans, will now be subjected to co-pays and out-of-pocket spending, those kinds of things. If people realize that, maybe they'll send different messages. But it's really, this has been all about politics, not about good policy, for a long time. And so we've seen the system elect a new president and put majorities into the House and Senate, and the same thing at the state level. And they've been running against the Affordable Care Act for a long time. So it would be incredibly surprising to see them not take some steps away from that. What that really means in the long run may not be known for a long time, but I think it's going to depend on messages coming from people who will have immediate and direct problems getting health insurance and how to pay for it if this goes away.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's Thomas Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about how a repeal of the Affordable Care Act could impact Wisconsinites. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.